Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio this week is...
Jason Rosenbaum.
And...
Marshall Griffin
from Jefferson City. I should have added that. Yes. So we're doing a split show this week, coming to you from two sides.
Yes. We haven't done this in a while, but we like to shake things up here on the Politically Speaking Podcast. After months of just having guests.
Yes. So we're going to get to a few topics. We're going to talk about the budget that's going to the Senate, I believe. Marshall can enlighten us about that. And then we're also going to get into the transportation tax. And then in the second half of our show, Jason, who are we going to have?
We will be talking with State Senator Paul Lavoda, a Democrat from Independence, about his journey into Missouri politics, about a potential about right to work and Medicaid passing through the Senate, and Democratic prospects of digging out of their deep, deep legislative hole in the General Assembly's upper chamber.
So let's get right down to it. Marshall, one of the legislature's biggest responsibilities is passing the budget. Where does it stand right now?
Right now, the Senate Appropriations Committee is going through the state budget. It's possible that it could be wrapped up today or possibly Thursday. They've been making some fairly quick progress on it. One notable thing that they did that could set up a showdown with the House, it seemed like the House and the Senate were mostly on the same page. It was them versus the governor. But the first real House versus Senate budget issue has come up. As you may know, the House Republicans are adamant that National Park Service is not doing a very good job of managing the Ozark National Scenic Riverways, and they've set aside $6 million to operate that park as a state park if they can agree to get the National Park Service or the federal government to agree to turn it over to the state. Highly unlikely, but they've set aside $6 million to do that. Well, the Senate Appropriations Committee, also Republican-led, stripped that money out, which is something that I'm sure has made a lot of House Democrats very happy, because there was some very strong war of words over who would make a better steward of the National Scenic Riverways and the current Jack's Fork River in that area.
Now, Marshall, every year there seems to be some sort of thing that caused the House and the Senate to be at loggerheads over the budget. Maybe this is one of those things. But do you see any other big issues that are going to cause a showdown like we've seen in previous years? Or is the fiduciary situation of the state stabilized enough to where it's going to be relatively uneventful this year?
This is just my opinion, but I don't think we're going to see a huge showdown between the House and the Senate, even with this difference over the spending on Ozark National Scenic Riverways. I think that will probably resolve itself, and I don't see any major conflict brewing between the House and the Senate over the budget. The main battle line is, at this point, still remains House and Senate Republicans on one side and Democratic Governor Jay Nixon on the other. I don't think that's changed at this point. Now, of course, there's still 5.5 weeks left to go. Anything can happen. But at this point, it still looks like the House and the Senate Republicans, for the most part, are still on the same page.
And the biggest difference between those two sides, the House and Senate Republicans and Democratic Governor Jay Nixon, would be allocating money for Medicaid, I assume?
Of course, yeah. In fact, it's still looking very bleak, very grim for Medicaid expansion to have any chance. And that includes a limited expansion mixed with reforms that's being sought by some House Republicans and also now by Senator Ryan Silvey. Even that remains very bleak as far as getting through this year.
And we'll be talking about that later on the show with Senator Lavoda, and we tentatively have Senator Silvey booked for next week to talk about his plan. So that's a little bit of a preview for our listeners, but continue.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was not present at the time that this happened because I was covering another story at the time. This is sometimes the downside to to being the only person in Jefferson City is that you cover something good and you miss something else that's just as good or sometimes great. And what I'm referring to in this case is the blow up that happened on the Senate floor between Republicans Ryan Silvey and John Lamping over this alternate Medicaid proposal that Sylvie is hoping to get through.
Yeah, I listened to that online.
It was really amazing. You know, they were going at it pretty heavily for 20 minutes. And
got pretty heated.
It got very heated. It was something to behold, as from what I've told. I have just received a copy of it in a few minutes ago in my email. So something I'll listen through. And of course, this happened last week, but this could possibly affect how other things happen in the Senate. You just never know. You know, can Lamping and Sylvie set this aside and work together on other issues, or will this you know, become a sore point that could affect other things?
That's always
the wild.
Lamping's only going to be in the legislature until September, and then he's leaving. So there's only a finite amount of time for this relationship to heal, I would assume.
Well, this leads us into our second topic,
yes,
in which Lamping may play another very important role in.
Transportation tax, which is an issue that I think Marshall and I have both been following pretty closely for the last year or two. Marshall, just kind of explain what this proposal would do and how it would impact the state's transportation infrastructure.
Well, basically, it would create a temporary 1 cent sales tax that would go toward transportation needs. It would only be in effect for 10 years. It would need voter approval to become part of the Constitution. It would be a constitutional amendment. And for 10 years, a 1 cent sales tax would be in effect that would be used for transportation needs across the state. From my understanding, 10% of that funding, 5% of that funding would be designated for county needs, another 5% for city and municipal needs.
So right.
That would include funding for mass transit, for transportation systems. So it wouldn't just be roads, highways, and bridges. It would be whatever transportation needs that a local or county municipality feels is needed.
Right. For example, if a pot of money went to St. Louis County and St. Louis City, I guess they could hypothetically decide to spend that on Metro, which is the train and bus service that serves both those counties. But continue.
Yes. And it would need voter approval after 10 years if they wanted to keep it in place. Now, as far as the estimates, it could raise billions of dollars in revenue or, depending on your viewpoint, take millions of dollars away from revenue and away from other services. The one solid figure that I've seen is just over $700 million for the first year that it's in effect. I believe 712. I'll have to look that number up. The people that are pushing this are saying this, that Missouri is losing money. I mean, we've already seen this, that Missouri's transportation system is they've got a real money crunch. Their outlook is bleak. They've put a freeze on adding new projects to their 5-year construction program. You know, they're estimated to only have, I believe, $450 or $350 million available to just maintain the current highway system in an upcoming about 3 or 4 years from now. So it's a pretty bleak picture. They just adopted a 20-year long-range plan that they've already admitted they can't really afford, or can't really afford to put into place all the things they would want to do with this plan. So they've got to come up with something.
And there was a bicycle kerfuffle, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. There was language. There was an amendment that was floated by Representative Paul Kirkman that would have removed the word bicycle from this bill, meaning that he basically said that, you know, that a constitutional amendment should not be approved or enacted just to be able to keep and maintain bicycle trails. He just thought that really didn't belong in a bill that's meant to address roads, highways, bridges, and other big transportation needs. And that caused a real stink, you know, with bicycle groups. Representative Chris Kelly basically said, you know, a lot of people use bicycle, you know, lanes along roads that go across bridges. You know, if you're going to take that out, you know, you're going to upset a lot of bicyclists. You know, it's just not going to fly. You're going to lose support for this, you know, bill that could do a lot of good if you take that word out. And eventually it was Kirkman did not contest the amendment being defeated. So that's out of the way.
Jason, what do you think of this bill's chances of passing?
What do I think that the chances of it passing are? Low. and here's why. And Marshall knows this too. So I think it will I think it was perfected, and I think it's actually being debated as we're recording this. So my assumption is it's going to pass the House, similar to what happened last year. But
yeah.
I don't really see how much has changed in the last year to prevent it from running into the John Lamping, Ed Emery, Rod Schaff filibuster wall that killed it last year. And it also was opposed by our guest, Paul Lavoda of Independence. He spoke during that filibuster and said that he was opposed to it because he was afraid, among other things, that it was going to take money away from other services like schools. Yeah. And unless they decide to previous question this, which would be Republicans previous questioning other Republicans, I just don't see how anything has changed to where the same result wouldn't happen. And frankly, I'm kind of surprised they're going the legislative route, given that this obstacle still exists this year. I've read reports that the handlers behind this aren't even circulating petitions, which is kind of risky at this point in time. If they're not doing that, and I could be wrong, they may be doing something simultaneously. It just seems like a situation where they're putting all their eggs in a legislative basket that has a giant hole in it, essentially. That's my terrible metaphor for the day. But Marshall, isn't that kind of your expectation as well, or do you see it happening differently?
I haven't seen anything coming out of the Senate that would be different from what happened last year. Unless there's some really significant horse trading that's going on behind the scenes, I really don't see it getting out of the Senate. And frankly, I'm surprised too that the initiative petition approach has not been tried, or at least tried aggressively at this point. I do think that if this resolution does fail again this year, like it did last year, we might see an amped up citizen initiative petition drive to get this passed.
If they haven't started collecting signatures yet, and again, I don't know whether that's true, but I've read reports that, I mean, if this fails in April or May, the deadline to turn in signatures, I believe, is May.
Well, I was actually thinking 2016.
Okay.
Maybe I should have added that in.
Yeah.
For this year, it would be out, but maybe I'm thinking an aggressive petition drive that would aim at 2016, or maybe possibly 2015 if that's doable. I'm thinking all their eggs are in one basket for this year.
All right. Well, we're gonna take a brief break, but when we're back, we'll have our guest. Jason, why don't you tell us a little bit about him and what his district encompasses?
Well, Senator Lavoda is the former House Minority Leader. He is the senator. Let me start over.
Yeah,
Senator Lavoda is a former House Minority Leader. His Senate district encompasses most of the city of Independence and parts of eastern Jackson County and the western part of the state. And he's had kind of an interesting political path to the legislature. He was one of those people that we talk about on the show occasionally who tried at first to get into the legislature or into office but failed, but then kept trying and eventually won. And I think that he's probably one of the future leaders within the Missouri Senate Democratic Caucus, especially as some of the current leaders like Joey Justice leave due to term limits. So it will be interesting to hear his take not only on the future of Medicaid and right to work, but also his thoughts on how the Democrats are going to expand their number in a chamber. As I mentioned before, they're in a very, very deep hole. And
we'll be right back. And we're back. Joining me in studio in St. Louis is Jason Rosenbaum, and joining us from Jefferson City is
State Senator Paul Lavoda.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Sorry I can't be there with you in St. Louis.
Well, it's not so beautiful in St. Louis today.
No.
So you're not missing out on too much.
It is not as beautiful as the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library, which I believe
is
in your
really.
District. So
yes. True.
You have kind of a lengthy tenure, not only in county politics, but also state politics. Tell me a little bit about what prompted you to get involved in elected office and just kind of about your political path that got you to the state Senate.
Sure. I guess I'll start at the beginning when I got involved in politics. My father, Sam Lavota, decided he was going to run for city council. And he drove us to a neighborhood, gave me a stack of brochures, pointed at the neighborhood and said, go walk door to door. So at 8 years old, I was in politics. From there, he ran the Jackson County campaign for Jerry Litton, helped out Ike Skelton in that area. And, you know, when you're around people like that, you're inspired to do great things. Additionally, when you grow up in Independence, home of Harry Truman, what an inspiration he is. A common man who made such an impact to the world that I kind of went down the path of thinking that public service was a great thing to do. So I did student council and college stuff, and then came back home, ran for state representative, unsuccessful, then ran, was successful, was in the House for 8 years, became minority leader, which is a great honor to lead the Democrats over there, and then in 2012 elected state senator, and I'm in my second year in the Senate.
And it should be noted for our listeners, especially listeners who have been looking at MEC filings and seen people who have donated $275,000 for their own state Senate race. Senator Lavota did not have a primary opponent or a general election opponent, so his path to the Senate seat was a little bit easier than some people who are running for office this year. That's kind of an aside, but
it was. I'll acknowledge that, but I also say that I had kind of a tough going at first when I ran for the House, and I think working hard and being there for the constituents, reaching out in many different ways, kind of showed my work ethic and that I was dedicated to the district. And I think that had a lot to do with the fact that people felt like I was the right person for senator.
And as kind of an aside, I believe either your second or third reelection, you actually defeated Noel Torpy, who ended up being your successor and who we'll be talking about in a few minutes because he's involved in the Medicaid situation.
I beat him in 2002 and 2004.
Yes. So there you go.
Yeah.
It's one of those situations, as we've talked about on the show with Paul Kirtman, of people who have run against each other but are now serving in the legislature at the same time. So you're part of that exclusive club. So
yes.
Congratulations on that.
Very exclusive.
But let's kind of dive in right about issues right now. As I kind of alluded to, last week the Senate kind of got into a pretty high-profile and sometimes heated discussion about Medicaid expansion. One of your colleagues from the Kansas City area, Ryan Silvey, has not necessarily introduced a bill because I guess it's too late to introduce legislation, but he's introduced kind of a conceptual plan about quote-unquote Medicaid transformation or Medicaid reform. Now, before we get into that, what is kind of your view of this issue and what would you like to see happen? Because I know that the Democratic wish here on Medicaid is probably different than even some people on the Republican side are trying to do pragmatic things. So before we get into that specific, what is kind of your lay of the land on this issue?
Well, I have sponsored the Medicaid expansion bill for 2 years. Last year had a hearing on the bill, had 30 people testify in favor of it from all different types of groups, employers, workers, patients, doctors, everybody, and then there was one person against it. By party vote, it went down. I reintroduced that bill again this year, and then on the House floor, I tried to attach straight Medicaid expansion on a bill, again, by party line, and went down. We have an opportunity to pull down all of our federal money that you and I as Missourians pay to benefit 300,000 people to help them with health care, but also build businesses in our state. It's foolish not to do that. Straight Medicaid expansion is the easiest and simplest way to do that, but because it is all involved in the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, there's not much appetite for that. So, last week, I forget what day it was, but I began inquiry of one of the proponents of it, opponents of it, Senator Lamping, and we had a heated argument, I guess, on the floor. And then the next day, our Republican, as you mentioned, Ryan Silvey, had a similar argument, even more heated. So I think the common sense of trying to do something that's a Missouri solution may be making sense as opposed to radical obstructionists that we see against this type of idea.
There are some people who have said that Medicaid expansion or transformation or basically anything that would take it up to 138 just isn't going to happen until there are some more concrete repercussions. Do you agree with that assessment? And if so, what do you think those repercussions will be that will be persuasive?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not sure what you mean by concrete repercussions.
Like rural hospitals closing down as a result of Medicaid not being expanded?
You know, I don't know. I mean, we've made it very clear, the hospital association, the individual hospitals, like I said, patients, doctors, they've been pretty concrete. We've seen what it's done for other states. I'm not sure how more concrete we need to get. The fact that it's Obamacare, I think, is still the real issue. The weird part of it is that if you really believe in some local control and that Missouri can do it better than the federal government, then we certainly should expand Medicaid to 138% and make a Missouri solution. That's how we could really take control of it and have something that's beneficial for our state.
It seems like the opponents of at least in the Senate, fall into kind of two categories. One is the person who I talked about almost ad nauseum, Rob Schaff of St. Joseph, who is opposed to Medicaid expansion. He has very specific counter proposals of what he wants to do. And we've kind of talked offline about, you know, certificate of need and price transparency. It seems like maybe, as we've talked about, he could possibly be worked with eventually. But then there are these other senators, kind of like Senator Lamping, Senator Emery, who are just philosophically opposed under any circumstances to Medicaid expansion. And my question is, how do you kind of overcome those two tiers of opposition, not only this year but in the future? And is there kind of a path forward either for the Medicaid expansion you would like to see or a Missouri solution, as you mentioned?
Yeah, you know, I don't know the path forward because, you know, when you keep coming up with facts that helps the people of Missouri and that the majority of people want this and they keep coming back with reasons not to do it, it's hard to overcome that. When they're so much in their radical obstructionist, they're going to go ahead and hurt the people of Missouri because they don't want this proposal. As far as Senator Schaff's ideas, there may be some merit to it. I don't see anything that he has that actually increases access to health care. It may make some things a little bit better when it comes to transparency. But that's how you get it. You know, we all need to be at the table to try to figure this out. And I would hope that he's at the table saying, yeah, we should bring our federal tax money back home, and we should make our health care have more people have access to it and make it more transparent. That's the way to do it.
Well, I think he's going to be a key figure. If Medicaid doesn't expand this year and he wins –
which it looks like it won't.
And if he wins re-election this year, which is not necessarily a sure thing, but he has won before, I think in the future he's going to be a key figure about whatever comes out of this. So we'll have to see.
Well, I agree. I mean, in his background as a doctor lends to that, his tenacious opposition to anything that has to do with – giving more people access to health care, that has something to do with it, and we'll see how that goes.
Now, the other thing that's kind of been in the news recently is, and I'm putting it in quotation marks because people get a little finicky about it, right to work or right to work for less. It involves, and I wish Joe were here because she can always explain it better than I can, but it's about how – maybe you could explain what the proposal is better than I could. What is at stake here?
Well, the proposal is to pass a law where state government gets in the middle of some type of collective bargaining between companies and their employees. It basically says what we currently have now is that they get to decide the terms of employment between the employees and the company. But now we're going to put in a state law that says, oh, well, those employees that don't want to follow that type of agreement by joining the union and getting the benefits of that don't have to. I mean, it really is government getting in the middle of business, which the proponents of this measure don't want to bring up. It is a way for businesses to drive down wages, drive down quality, and really is going to hurt the people of Missouri overall.
So just for our listeners, Right to Work basically would it would make it so that employers can't make union membership a requisite for employment.
Right, and they wouldn't have to honor that with those folks.
Yes.
Right.
I just full disclosure, I'm terrible at explaining it. I can explain it in the story, but I just can't do it off the top of my head. So I appreciate Chris and the senator for doing that.
No problem.
Yeah, I think the reason why, you know, I said at the very onset of session that I just didn't think this had any chance of passing because if it ever got past the House, which I don't think is a sure thing because there are a lot of Republicans who are from union-heavy districts and who are pretty supportive of organized labor who I think are going to vote against it, it's going to run into just this brick filibuster wall in the Senate because I imagine all nine Democrats are going to filibuster this. We actually had Senator Justice on our show a few weeks ago, and she said there's not really a scenario where the Democrats are just going to lay down, let this go through, and let this be on the ballot so it might hurt Republicans in legislative elections. I take it that hasn't changed since she was on the show. Is that a fair assessment that there will be a pretty big filibuster?
You know, I can only speak for myself, and I'm certainly there. I will do everything I can to stop because it's bad legislation for middle class in Missouri. It really does reduce wages, reduce jobs, and it's just not good for us overall. And it is, you know, there's no proof that it would add to our state. It just simply big companies that don't want to have to go through the problem of dealing with unions. That's really all it's about.
Now, there are a couple of things at play here, and a lot of this has to do with kind of numbers and inside baseball. But, I mean, do you think this would be something that the Republicans would unleash the previous question on? And do you think that there are 18 votes among Republicans to not only PQ this but pass it? Because I can think of people off the top of my head, you know, Ryan Silvey, Gary Romine, Kurt Schaefer, Eric Schmidt, Tom Dempsey, Wayne Wallingford. There might be one or two out here who are kind of had union support in the past. Mm-hmm. And I just am not 100% convinced that the votes are there to pass in the Senate. So I guess that's a two-part question. Do you think this would be something the Republicans would actually use the PQ on? And do you think there are enough votes to even pass it if it ends up coming to a vote?
Well, you know, I don't know. It's hard to speak for other senators, but there hasn't been a lot of talk about such legislation in the Senate so far. I think if you saw an appetite for it, you would have saw a Senate bill moving further. We'll see what happens if the House passes something, what type of pressure the majority gets on this. But right now, we haven't had that bill in the Senate.
Now, the other bill that is moving down the process, again, I'm using jargon here. It's paycheck protection / paycheck deception. And I think I can actually explain this a little better. It would require like written authorization for union members to have their dues used for, I guess, political purposes, if I'm not mistaken. If I'm wrong on that, I apologize to our tens and listeners.
Send all email to Jason Rosenbaum.
Yeah. But that actually ended up, I believe, passing both chambers last year. It got vetoed. It didn't really end up going through veto session. What are the prospects for that bill, in your view?
Well, they passed well, just to correct, it does do that on the political side, but it also says that it's usually for public employee unions. Those municipalities or whatever they may be, the school districts, don't have to or are not allowed to take their dues out of their check.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, that's a common thing that the union would negotiate with their employer, and government is getting involved there. But with that said, there was something passed last week in the House by 83 votes, the bare minimum of what you have to get done. I don't know if we'll see it in the Senate or not, but, I mean, it's clear that there will be fierce opposition to that if it comes to the Senate. I'm going to be one of the leaders against that because it is such a cynical election year bill just to pick on public employee unions who traditionally have been Democrats. But if you look recently, they've supported many Republicans in the state. But it's just a way to play politics and get in the middle of hurt our teachers and our firefighters and those public employees. So we're going to do everything we can to fight it. But then again, it may not come up because Governor Nixon will veto it again, and they only have 83 votes. You need 109 to pass something in the House to override a veto. So their support for that is even dwindling in the House.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that version has a referendum clause on it, but if it does, I guess that isn't to play. But it, you know, this it could be a bill that doesn't have a referendum clause that goes to the
that
Senate.
That is true. That is true. You know what? I think you're right. I think there is a referendum on that because they know that Governor Nixon would be against that. But you know, they're going to face a lot of opposition in the Senate with that bill.
And that kind of almost transitions into our next topic. Yes. of Senate elections, because Senator Lavota is in charge of the Senate Democratic effort this year. And I talked about this a little bit on last week's show and have written about it. This is probably not the most robust election season as far as electoral races. I mean, the statewide is unopposed. There are some state Senate seats where I guess they were previously competitive but are not competitive this time around. But mm-hmm. what's kind of your thought process on what the Democratic Senate Democratic focus is this year, and which particular races are going to be on your radar? And I would assume like a lot of them are going to be in the St. Louis area, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we have a kind of an advantage that the way the Senate Democrats work around their election. Is that those who don't have an election serve on that committee. So we have six of us. We've decided to put together a six-year plan as opposed to a two-year plan. And our goal is to get veto-proof numbers within the next couple election cycles. Off-year elections are always difficult for recruiting and just for Democrats in general. We are very excited about an opportunity to pick up a seat in the 24th District. And I'm sure you've talked about that. In fact, I think you had Jill Shoup on.
We have. And continue.
And so we're going to help her. But, you know, she is right on the issue. She's a hard worker. She knows her district.
And her senatorial district would be to replace Senator John Lamping,
who's not running for re-election.
And when she wins, it will have a little to do with how much we help her. It has to do with her tenacity and how good she is for the district. Mm-hmm. Another district on our radar is the 22nd District. It was Senator McKenna's before he was appointed. We have a great candidate, Jeff Rorta, running for that. It's, again, a candidate who knows the district, works hard, doing everything they need to do politically to win that district. So we're excited about that. The next one that we look at is the 10th District, which is a little tricky because it moved. It's currently Senator Justice District, but it moved through redistricting. We have a candidate named Ed Schieffer who's going to be competitive in that district, a Democrat who does very well in rural areas, again, doing what he needs to do. And then the next one I'll mention is the 34th District, which is currently Senator Schaaf's district. There is a man by the name of Dr. Bob Stuber, who's a physician up in St. Joe, who, because of Medicaid expansion and Dr. Schaaf's opposition to it, decided to run. Mm-hmm. So some of these issues will come back and be part of the political process as well. Now, I didn't mention the 13 other races that we have because either because of an incumbent or redistricting or whatever it may be, we don't become as competitive. Mm-hmm. But we believe if we can keep our 10, maybe get to 11, we can make some progress in 2016 to be veto proof.
Now, before we get into the nitty gritty on the races, is there kind of some lingering disappointment that for some of the seats that were somewhat competitive in 06 and 2010, you know, the Brian Munslinger seat, the Bob Dixon seat, the Dan Brown seat, that the Democrats aren't competing there? Or was that kind of just reality that because of redistricting or because the incumbent has a lot of money, it just wasn't worth it to field a strong candidate there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think redistricting has a lot to do with it. I mean, you look at Senator Munslinger's district has become more Republican after that. And number two, term limits really do affect these things. As you can see, there's going to be a competitive race in the 24th and the 22nd, and they're open seats. So that really makes a difference. I talked to a lot of candidates potential candidates through recruiting, and then I'll say, well, we'll wait till it's an open seat. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate because we're not able to build the Democratic message all the way through. But that's kind of the reality. I think the House has the same type of issue.
So let's get in – again, now let's actually get into the nitty-gritty because there's no competitive auditor's race, some of these Senate races are going to be the marquee races of the cycle between candidates. As Chris mentioned last week, some ballot initiatives might become very prominent. But in my view, the battle for Jeffco, as I've called it, in the 22nd District, I think is, and kind of surprisingly, one of the main events this cycle. And the 24th, I think, is up there too. But we don't know who's going to come out of that primary on the Republican side. And as you kind of alluded to, it's a Democratic-leaning district where the Jill Shoup has a lot of advantages. But one thing I want to ask you is there are a lot of senators who are either not running this cycle or who are unopposed on the Republican side who have pretty substantial war chests. Is it kind of a fear among Democrats that come January, August, September, some of those people are going to direct those money, that money to Jeffco and to St. Louis County and to Northeast Missouri? Or is that just kind of something that you're well prepared for by getting the candidates that you need?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I don't think it's a fear. It's an expectation. We know that's going to happen. It will happen. They're going to be competitive where they can be competitive. And in a world of no campaign finance limits, they'll raise unlimited and then give unlimited. We believe, and history has shown, that that is a competitive district in 22nd District. If you get the right person in there with the right field and the right message, they're going to be okay. We're going to help them raise some money through our efforts, and we have a more coordinated than I've ever seen the Democratic Party with the assistance of Roy Temple and Chris Koster, really helping coordinate some things. We're going to be prepared for that. And I say that, but Jeff Roeder's going to be prepared for that. You know how tenacious he is.
Yeah. And one other question before I guess we let you go. Is there also kind of any worry that since Schweik isn't running against a Democrat, he might take some of that war chest and direct it towards Senate and House races? Or, as Steve Kraske pointed out in his column a couple weeks ago, is the expectation there that he might just save that for his gubernatorial run and maybe that money Koster and potentially others give may be, you know, just as impactful?
Yeah, I don't know what the auditor will do. I think Kraske's guess is as good as the next. I would find it hard to believe if he gave a lot of his money to the Senate effort.
Yeah. And one final question. If you had to guess, what would you say how many Democrats will be in the Senate at the start of 2015?
We're gonna have 11.
11.
I'm gonna be optimistic.
Okay. We'll hold you to that. And you know, if you're wrong, I'm gonna call shenanigans on you. So
fair enough. Hey, I don't know if you mentioned this yet, but I think I should have done this in my introduction, that this is kind of a big deal that I'm on the show, because I have my own podcast that talks politics called Dialogue,
a competing podcast
with Senator Lavota.
Yes.
And you know, I don't know if David Letterman ever got Jay Leno on, but this is a big deal that I'm hopefully helping you guys get some listeners.
Well,
and for all the folks who want to listen, you go in your iTunes and you search for Lavota, and it's there, and you hear it every week.
Wow, we've never had a guest promote his own podcast on our podcast.
It is. I hear it's the number two Missouri politics podcast in the state.
Well, I think it's number one. You guys may want to look into that, but if not, we're coming at you.
Oh my God, we are in serious trouble here.
Right, and shenanigans may be coming. Beware.
Well, thank you for joining us, even though you're trying to steal away our listeners. But to close us out here, you can read all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. Jason, you can be followed.
Jay Rosenbaum.
And Senator, you can be followed on Twitter.
Yes, @PaulLavota.
Very good. Well, we'll be back next week. Until then, so long.
So long.